This is September 21st, 2008, and this will be the first of two teshos on distraction, or to use the subtitle of the book I'll be reading from, called Distracted, the Erosion of Attention and the Coming Dark Age, by Maggie Jackson. Maggie Jackson, I see in the back cover, is an award-winning author and journalist who writes the popular Balancing Acts column in the Boston Globe. Her work has also appeared on National Public Radio, the New York Times, among other publications. Her first book is called What's Happening to Home? Balancing Work, Life, and Refuge in the Information Age. This is a book someone sent me. I'm very grateful to him for having sent it, because she articulates this lurking suspicion I've had for years that virtual multitasking, restless new world is coming at a very serious cost to us, certainly spiritually. It's been hard to not second-guess myself about this. I can hear when I think of my concerns about what this new cyber world, what it's doing to us, I can hear others, especially young people, saying, wow, you're just not with it. You're not with the program. You're just stuck in the past, and you're a dinosaur, and start, you know, join the 21st century. But she presents a lot of very deeply thoughtful views about this, and research based on research. And I feel it's sort of my obligation as a teacher to pass this on to my Sangha. It's an ambitious book. It's really quite a remarkable book in its scope. And I would never be able to even hit the high points, or even hit most of the high points in one teisho. So I've made peace with splitting into two teishos. The second one will be a week from today. And the first one today will be mostly laying out the problem, what we're up against. I'll save most of my commentary for next week, where I relate it more to practice and the challenge facing those of us who practice. I'm just going to wade into this. Let me just read from her introduction. The premise of this book is simple. The way we live is eroding our capacity for deep, sustained, perceptive attention. The building block, that is attention, the building block of intimacy, wisdom, and cultural progress. Moreover, this disintegration may come at a great cost to ourselves and to society. There are three sections to the book. In the first section, there are three chapters about... the first two chapters are about the effects of virtual virtual experience, if you can call it that experience at all, the virtual world. And in the third chapter of this first section, she talks about the ways in which we have fallen prey to diffusion, fragmentation, the way our lives are splintered and interrupted. And in the third, excuse me, in the fourth of this first part, she talks about how hypermobile we've become. So just to start in on this, she says in her introduction, amid the glittering promise of our new technologies and the wondrous potential of our scientific gains, we are nurturing a culture of social diffusion, intellectual fragmentation, sensory detachment. In this new world, something is amiss, and that something is attention. Increasingly, we are shaped by distraction. William James described attention as a clear and vivid possessing of the mind, an ordering, and a withdrawal. We easily recognize that these states of mind are becoming less and less a given in our lives. The seduction of alternative virtual universes, the addictive allure of multitasking people and things, our near religious allegiance to a constant state of motion. These are markers of a land of distraction in which our old conceptions of time, space, and place have been shattered. This is why we are less and less able to see, hear, and comprehend what's relevant and permanent, why so many of us feel that we can barely keep our heads above water, and our days are marked by perpetual loose ends. What's more, the waning of our powers of attention is occurring at such a rate in so many areas of life that the erosion is reaching critical mass. We are on the verge of losing our capacity as a society for deep, sustained focus. In short, we are slipping toward a new dark age. We'll maybe find time next week to talk more about this dark age, but just this much, she says that a dark age is really a distinct turning point in history, a period of flux that often produces great technological and other gains, yet ultimately results in a declining civilization and a desert-like spell of collective forgetting. This is what characterized the so-called Dark Ages after the fall of the Roman Empire. There are those who say that not only that we're all living in an age of the fall of the American Empire, but that it really, for the first time, became visible in a new way this past week with what's going on with our financial situation in this country. Harold Bloom calls this era a dark age of the screens. We all share the joke. Nearly a third of workers feel they often do not have time to reflect on or process the work they do. More than half typically have to juggle too many tasks simultaneously and or are so often interrupted that they find it difficult to get work done. One year-long study found that workers not only switch tasks every 3 minutes during their workday, but nearly half the time they interrupt themselves. And then chapter one is, she calls Wired Love, circa 1880. She focuses on, she starts with the whole world of virtual relationships. Teens describe instant messaging their peers as less enjoyable than face-to-face visits or phone calls, yet they say they prefer IM because it allows them to multitask each other. And then she quotes a teenager who told researchers, Personally, I like talking to a lot of people at a time. It kind of keeps you busy. It's kind of boring just talking to one person, because then, like, you can't talk to anybody else. let's see here. And then she says here, now we splinter our focus and plunge into alternative realities so often that perhaps we are losing the ability and will to question the consequences. We begin to take for granted that attention is a kind of noisy, manipulated, and splintered background. She quotes a critic, literary critic, Sven Birkerts, who I think puts this very well. He says, inundated by perspectives, by lateral vistas of information that stretch endlessly in every direction, we no longer accept the possibility of assembling a complete picture. So how many of us spend too much time just grazing through websites? Lateral vistas of information that stretch endlessly in every direction. At the cost of depth. How many different perspectives does one need? Need to gather and try to sort through. I've always been convinced that we have a choice in anything between breadth and depth. I will not accept that you can have both. The more you expose yourself to, the more time you spend surfing anything, even writings on Zen by other centers, other teachers, the more time you spend doing that, the more you sacrifice in the way of reaching real depth and personal experience. Talks about cyber mourning and the popular worldwide cemetery. And then she introduces the reader to this phrase, networked individualism. These are the words of a Barry Wellman, a leading researcher of social networks. We can connect with almost anyone at any time, but the connection is to the person and not to the place, and largely to a slice of the person and not the whole. So think MySpace and Facebook. She refers to this this phrase, reputation management, where with your singles websites and Facebook and so forth. Reputation management demands and inspires skills that are strikingly similar to those needed for successful gaming. A sense of mastery, an ability to remain aloof, an instinct for ranking others. And she quotes someone as saying, "What kind of love treats people like chess pieces?" She goes a lot more into these kinds of these formats that we don't have time for. But then in the end she says, at its heart, networked individualism is about diffusion. Connectivity is up, cohesion is down, says Wellman. So meanwhile, a quarter of Americans report having no close confidants. And this also involves email. Talks about how easy it is to just abruptly drop any kind of connection with someone by email or in these other ways. She says, disappearing is easy. All you have to do is not answer, leaving the sender to question what happened if they pause long enough to wonder. Sometimes you don't even mean to drop the ball, but you get busy, the email grows stale, the impetus to answer fades away. In modern society, we've always floated in and out of each other's lives, dropping well-intentioned white lies about getting together soon. But our rampant connectivity leads to an epidemic of loose ends, fueled by both the allure of endless options and by miscues rampant in a medium steeped in both uninhibited intimacy and venom. We are ghosts moving in and out of each other's consciousness, often silently, but sometimes with a shriek and a howl. It's very difficult with this technology, with email and this other technology, to resist, to not fall prey to what she's talking about. If we're getting bombarded with emails, it's so easy just to let them go, slip past and forget about them. She says, perhaps we're not disengaging completely from our old physical realities as much as gently choosing to downgrade them. When we do come together, especially with those we love, do we turn away? In updating our definitions of family for a new age, we've traded security for freedom and swapped the group for a loose network of kin. We don't seek suffocating ideals of obligatory togetherness day by day or over our lifetimes. Yet, so that's one extreme she's suggesting, yet all this changes the nature of family ties. And she quotes an Anthony Giddens in a book called The Transformation of Intimacy. Kinship relations used to be taken for granted on the basis of trust. Now trust has to be negotiated and bargained for, and commitment is as much an issue as in sexual relationships. The recombinant family spawns what could be called a drift toward the voluntary, read optional, that is, the voluntary or optional nuclear family. Family ties, along with all relations, become a matter of choice. With technology lessening the need for direct human interdependence of all kinds, association becomes a conscious act of will. it becomes easier to be lured away, to be tugged away, and to deliberately turn away, countering the demands of always-on connectivity with powerful ways to filter out noise, too muchness, and others. People are chess pieces and unwanted static. With self-serve airport kiosks, ATMs, online grocery delivery services, clothing catalogs, restaurant reservations, and, of course, the ubiquitous iPod, it has become possible to filter almost every possible human interaction, writes Kate Zernike, adding that a minivan with a DVD is just a mobile way for parents to edit out their own children. V-chip your television. V-chip your mom, she writes, leave nothing to chance. But isn't chance at the heart of what constitutes the material, earthly, flesh and blood world? Contingency, or the presence of the unforethinkable, is at the heart of earthly reality, according to philosopher Albert Borgman. Contingency doesn't make life random or meaningless, he says, adding that in ancient times, contingency meant something like consummation. Rather, it attests to the, quote, unsurpassable eloquence of a society that often asks us to confront what we cannot control or even understand. A face-to-face meeting, which demands a mutual reading of body language, emotion, and soul, is harder to fathom and less predictable than a virtual encounter. But by losing the will to face one another, we are turning away from the messy, unpredictable, and real in life. Virtual pink slips, virtual condolences, virtual courtship, virtual custody visits, virtual lovers' breakups, all relegate the hard parts of life to a thinner, indirect realm. More than 70 years ago, E.B. White could see this coming. Media will remake our world and, quote, insist that we forget the primary and the near in favor of the secondary and the remote, he wrote. And then she quotes a Mark Sluka, who writes for Harper's, I know, as echoing this. He said, what surprises us now increasingly is the shock of the real, the nakedness of face-to-face communication, the rough force of the natural world. A mourner's tear, a lover's fallibility, these are becoming too much to bear. V-chip them out. I think this is really a very important point, and it articulates my reluctance, near refusal, to get involved with questions about practice by email, except for out-of-town people who can't get here. But I wonder, when people email me, local people, well, this is very unusual, it really is, but what are they thinking? Can't you get to Doksan once in a great while? Unless it's an emergency, that's something else, but then call me. You know, these things, all of these things that I'm going to be reading today and next week are things that were not problems in ancient times. We have an ancient tradition that presents, you know, for all of its hundreds of koans, showing interactions and all kinds of daily life situations. We're in uncharted waters here. This is new stuff. We can't look back to our forebears to know how to handle this, except in the broadest and really the most essential way, which is to keep going back and sitting and learning to be fully present and not absent or engaging with people, you know, virtually. This is why I'm just flabbergasted at teachers who will work on koans with their students by email. So she says the virtual becomes the preferred reality. People long have found ways to disconnect from each other, from sham marriages, insensitive parents, soured friendships, lost loves. But what if we choose to be satisfied by a steady diet of glimpses and little more? What if we, more often than not, opt to turn and drift away? We become attentional wanderers, sated by the mirage. So I see this as the real danger. It's not just what we're missing in any particular encounter with someone, but the habit we're developing, the habit of relating in this kind of ghost-like way with people. And then, not just the habit, not even just the habit, but the habit and then getting, having that become satisfied with that. And then these next two chapters are about fragmentation, diffusion, how splintered our way of relating to the world has become through our technology. She talks about TV, which I'll skip over because it just isn't time. And then she gets into multitasking, and she quotes David Meyer, who's from the University of Michigan, who's head of their Brain, Cognition, and Action Lab. I remember David Meyer from the conference I went to in June, the Mind and Life Summer Research Institute. He was one of the stars of the conference. Big boned, gruff, very outspoken guy, brilliant, obviously brilliant. And he has, she says he's made it a point in recent years, even at a cost to his time for other research, of warning anyone who will listen about the dangers of multitasking. It's an unrecognized scourge, he believes, akin to cigarette smoking a generation ago. Is he riding a hobby horse, perhaps overreacting a trifle? Certainly his call a spade demeanor has raised eyebrows in the button-down scientific community. So she, of course, asks that rhetorically and then presents all kinds of compelling support for his concern about multitasking. You know, multitasking has become so common. I do it myself sometimes. But especially to younger people, to the youngest people, teenagers and even younger, they take it so much for granted, I understand. They take it so much for granted that this is just what one does, that I've long felt it's kind of hopeless to suggest that they try single-tasking instead of multitasking. And we know that when our attention is split, we can't bring as much to any of the respective objects of our attention. It's just logical. Well, that would just be utterly fall on deaf ears of anyone who's really sold on multitasking. But here, this David Meyer presents some of the solid support for not multitasking. she talks a bit about the how we have evolved to sort of default to interruptions and to being scattered. First, she says that we had to learn to focus. She says, pausing along the trail to consider whether a plant was edible, our ancestors had to tune out their environment long enough to assess the would-be food. But they had to be better wired to almost unthinkingly notice the panther in the tree above, or they would have died out rapidly. So she says, we are born to be interrupt-driven. This is what we're up against in practice, as anyone who's sat for more than a round knows. We are born to be interrupt-driven. Our default position is to scatter our attention. I wish I had a dollar for every person who's asked, why is it so hard for me to keep my mind on my practice? We're wired to be that way. And she says, we must painstakingly learn and keep striving to retain the ever-difficult art of focus. Otherwise, we cede control to the environment, becoming a prisoner of the world. We cede control to the environment. This is where attention comes in. Do we want to, like monkeys, just react, respond to everything that flits through our field of attention? We really pay a price when we do that. We have to be able to hold the mind on one thing if we're going to find any depth in life. She says, when we multitask, we are like swimmers diving into a state of focus, resurfacing to switch gears or reassess the environment, then diving again to resume focus. This is a speeded up version of the push and pull we do all day. But no matter how practiced we are at either of the tasks we are undertaking, the back and forth produces switch costs as the brain takes time to change goals, remember the rules needed for the new task, and block out cognitive interference from the previous still vivid activity. And she quotes this Meyer, training can help overcome some of the inefficiencies by giving you more optimal strategies for multitasking. But except in rare circumstances, you can train until you're blue in the face and you'd never be as good as if you just focused on one thing at a time. Period. That's the bottom line. And that, she says, requires executive attention. This is one of three kinds of attention that I'll get into more next time. But this executive attention is what helps us to make decisions about where we're placing our attention and other things. She says, executive attention is a precious commodity. Relying on multitasking as a way of life, we chop up our opportunities and abilities to make big picture sense of the world and pursue our long-term goals. In the name of efficiency, that is, trying to do two or three or four things at once, we are diluting some of the essential qualities that make us human. And these costs that she's referring to are not costs, as we all know. They're not things that disable us. We can still be highly functional in our lives. But it's a deeper, more pernicious cost that we'll be saying more about here. Work fragmentation. We spend a great deal of our days trying to piece our thoughts and our projects back together and the result is often an accumulation of broken pieces with a raggedy coherence all its own. After studying workers at two West Coast high-tech firms for more than 1,000 hours over the course of a year, Mark sifted the data and was appalled. The fragmentation of work life, she says, was far worse than I could ever have imagined. Does this sound at all familiar to anyone? As well as coping with a high number of interruptions, workers have a tough time getting back on track once they are disconnected. She says, in other words, we are not only naturally catering to the needy toddler of a high-tech environment, but we are training ourselves to flit from task to task. And she quotes a Clive Thompson, a science writer, "To perform an office job today, it seems, your attention must skip like a stone across water all day long, touching down only periodically." And then she gets back to this David Meyer. She says, Meyer's voice rose. He was hollering. He was hollering in that conference I was at too. We were back in his university office, and he was attacking the myth that we can operate at top speeds on multiple tasks as well as if we were doing one at a time. That's ridiculous, he practically shouted. That's ludicrous. And then she says that he himself often multitasks, reading the New York Times, chatting with his granddaughter, watching television all at once. But that's for fun, he insisted. There's the problem. But then he says, I'm getting little bits and pieces of information as a result of engaging in each of these tasks. But the depth of what I'm getting, the quality of my understanding, is nowhere as good as if I was just concentrating on one thing. That's the bottom line. And then she said that once during our many conversations, he sadly confided the reason why he first began to be willing to speak up about multitasking. His 17-year-old son, Timothy, was broadsided and killed by a distracted driver who ran a red light. And then we have last week's train crash, where there's strong evidence that the conductor of the train was texting someone when he missed the red light and crashed into another train that killed 25 people. And then there's our hypermobility as a people. And this is all of one piece with our dwelling in virtual realities and our multitasking and the general diffusion. She gives some amazing statistics here. 40% of our food budgets are spent eating out. Now, and then this one. 25% of restaurant meals are ordered from the car. So we've touched on what she calls the keys to decoding the landscape of distraction. The first is the virtual. The virtual shatters our conceptions of space. And then the illusion of simultaneity as we're multitasking redefines our notions of time. And so a life of perpetual movement reshapes our relationship to place and what it means to be in the world. This is where we as Americans outdo all other peoples, for sure. Is even Alexis de Tocqueville, back in the 19th century, described the restless Americans and our need to be constantly moving on. Or in the frontier days, there was this saying, settle and sell, settle and sell. Settle down, move west, settle down. Stay there a little while, sell again. Sell and move on again. Grazing, browsing, surfing, hoteling, hot desking, whatever that is, travel, soccer, dashboard dining, the very vocabulary of our daily lives denotes an adoration of motion. We scorn the idea of stopping. Look at what we're up against, you know, a tradition that honors stillness and settling down, crossing the legs, or even in our daily lives, stilling the mind. We scorn the idea of stopping, equating the local and the immobile with social deprivation and degradation. We increasingly shape our lives around portability. Portability of contacts, of knowledge, of entertainment, of nourishment, and selves. And this changes how we sense and pay attention to the world. 14% of Americans move annually. For the first time, cars are coming equipped with closets. It's not so much moving for a job or a love or an ideal that stirs us anymore. It's moving for movement's sake. A couple of years ago, she says, there were 1,347 products with Go on the label that debuted on the global market, a nearly 50% increase from the previous year. Foods are looking more and more like astronaut fare, concentrated, minimalized, single serve. We buy crustless frozen peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and dinner kits that come in their own bowls. Liquid meals, once the preserve of hospital patients, are in vogue. Food is functional. It's a bar. You eat and you've got your meal, says so-and-so, head of merchandising at 7-Eleven. The body is a machine, and the job of food is to keep the machine running. And this is just about food. There's a lot more fascinating stuff about food. She suggests that we are neo-nomads, powering through mobile days fueled by jet-set sustenance. She suggests that this notion of being nomads is a little flattering. We call ourselves cyber nomads or digital nomads, imbuing our virtual journeys with the dignity and weight of this ancient way of life. But Nonetheless, there are some similarities. She says, nomads focus on the landscape and its features, sites, tracks, water holes, lairs, sanctuaries, birthplaces, landmarks. And she says, today, read malls, highways, drive-through restaurants, offices, billboards, both earthly and virtual. Nomads focus on one another in the same way, keeping those in clearest focus who live in intimate proximity and for whom, at the same time, they have intense feelings. Relationships are fluid, a preface to ours in the boundary-less postmodern world, and self-sufficiency is highly prized, again, as it is in our own day. And then she quotes a British critic, Marina Warner, "What is needed is a new emphasis on the real, palpable, and fleshed materiality of our surroundings. What is needed is a way to counter our detachment from the world, recover the strength of deep connections, salvage wholeness in perception and thinking. In this land of distraction, we begin to rely on fragments, snippets, and push-button answers, and this is not a step forward. That is the beginning of a cultural decline." All right, now that just sets us up for going into the deeper implications of all this next week. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.